guy. That's the masses.
Welcome back to another episode of Give Me Some Truth. An exciting episode. Well, not more exciting than any of the rest of them. They're all exciting as we
think.
Incredibly
exciting.
But exciting from the fact that we have a guest in the booth with us, in the room with us. We feel that it's really, really important for our clients to hear not only what we think of the world, but what other experts think of the world. And we have an expert with us, Andrew Updike, an economist at First Trust. I'll let you speak to your biography a little bit, if you would, and let people know kind of where you came from and how you got here.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the first time I think I've heard people excited to talk to an economist.
I mean, if you're not excited to talk to an economist, I mean, come on, what are we even doing, really? I mean, let's be honest.
So my background, I did my undergrad in economics at Hope College in Western Michigan. I did my grad school at Northwestern, the CFA program. I've been working with the team at First Trust for about 15 years. I spent a couple years in the tech industry before that. But my role is to review all the data. I care about the numbers that come in. Right? Economics is very math heavy. And the idea is there's theories that go back tens of years, hundreds of years, thousands of years on how the world operates. What we're looking at, right, on a day-to-day basis is what is the data telling us? What do the numbers tell us? Because you turn on the TV, you turn on the radio, you open up the newspaper, you hear one thing. How much can we discern from what is physically taking place? And part of that job for me, I travel the country. I spend about 45 weeks of the year on the road. I also spend some time in Canada.
45 weeks of the year.
Yeah, about 100 flights a year, about 120 nights in hotel rooms.
That's a lot of miles.
It is a lot of miles. It's a lot of time. But you know what it does is it lets me see what it looks like across the country and around the world. Because especially during times like COVID, right, how things were progressing, opening up, changing in somewhere like California versus Texas versus Florida versus Wisconsin or Illinois looked incredibly different. So our idea, our goal is to see all the numbers, hear all the numbers, and then talk to businesses across the country, around the world, to see how their situation matches up, because there's always more depth beneath the data.
What's the best hotel you've stayed in? What's like the best hotel that you say, if I'm going somewhere, this is where I'm going?
The Post Oak in Houston. Is one of my favorite hotels in the country. The Four Seasons that's down in Orlando by Disney is an absolutely phenomenal hotel. And in Chicago, I think the Peninsula Hotel in Chicago is one of the best in the country.
Right, there you go. Okay. Should we just end it there? That's the end. I guess we're good.
The travel segment.
We covered it.
I expect we're going to get comments on the video on YouTube about the hotel preferences, but we'll see. Maybe more so than about the topic itself.
Exactly,
We'll leave comments.
We've thought that we'll break this down into four categories or three categories, kind of depending on the time that we have. Scylla and I talked about what we're hearing from clients and specifically what people think that maybe keeps them up at night or they look at it and go, I just don't know what's happening there. And or even why is that important, right? So I think what we want to cover is inflation. That seems to be a very, very not only important economic topic, but it really seems to have resonated with the average American and the average international client as well. Unfortunately, we do have to talk about politics because it's an election year. That's how the world works. And so we'll talk about that briefly. And then I think we'll also want to get into debt a little bit because there's been huge changes in the debt market in the last handful of years. And then maybe finally just take the temperature of a garden variety multinational corporation and see how we feel like they are doing right now. So I guess let's just go in order if we would. Inflation. What should we be thinking about? What should we? What is happening that we're not hearing about that actually matters?
Yeah, you know, inflation has been such a confusing topic for so many people because it's like over the last few years, you kind of had to throw out the textbook. So much of what's happened over the last 4 years, if you took an Econ 101, 201, took grad level classes, they didn't prepare you for this, right? There was no class about what happens when you have a pandemic, a shutdown, and 22 million people lose their job. They have no textbook that says, here's what the response looks like from whether that's the Federal Reserve, the ECB, the Bank of Japan. And so now emerging from this and kind of trying to get back towards quote unquote normal has led to some unique situations. And again, if you were watching TV, listening to the newspaper, if you listen to the Fed, remember they told us you're not going to have to worry about this. Back in 2020 into 2021, they said if inflation comes, it's going to be transitory, right? Anything we're going to see is going to be short-term effects. They told us they had put out a projection that by the end of 2021, inflation would be down to 1.7%. Where were we at the end of 2021? At 7.0%. So to their credit, right, they got one of the numbers right. They just had the 7 in the wrong spot. Then they were convinced, right, that they would have inflation down to 2% by the end of 2022. And all they had to do was get 3 rate hikes. Instead, we got 17 and inflation remained elevated. I think the tricky thing, beyond just the money that came into the system, the stimulus that flowed around the world, that there's no other way to explain a year like 2020 where you ended the year down close to 10 million workers and spending was at all-time record highs, right? Sure. And so that money coming into the system, that had an effect. The changes that we made in terms of how we operate, instead of being at the sporting events, instead of being out at the restaurants, we moved from the outside inside, and all of a sudden we needed the world brought to us. There were supply chain disruptions. So what do? We shifted so much of the economy. We shifted investment dollars. We shifted resources to deal with the supply chain issue. Well, come the middle of 2021, all of a sudden the consumer started to shift back to the service side of the economy, and there's been this dislocation because the workers are not necessarily in the right spots.
Got it.
And the Fed, again, because they only control so much, one of the things that they've been battling, though I don't think they'll come out and say it. They try to stay out of the political spectrum, right? But think about how Congress and the Fed have kind of been working at opposition with each other. You've got the Fed saying, we want to raise rates and make it more expensive to borrow and buy a house, more expensive to borrow and buy a car, more expensive to borrow and invest in a business.
Because
the goal here,
inflation under control.
Let's bring demand down. That's the side that they can control, right? At least in their minds, that's what they control. But then you look at some of the numbers and you see things like manufacturing, where 17 of the last 18 months, when they get surveyed by the Institute for Supply Chain Management, they said our orders are down, our production's down, and yet manufacturing construction spend has doubled over that time period. The books don't tell you, right? There's no economics book or no business management book that says if you have less work, you should clearly expand capacity. So what's going on? One of the tricky things in this environment is that at the same time the Fed was raising rates, we got the Inflation Reduction Act, we got the CHIPS Act. And they're looking and saying, look, you know, semiconductor manufacturing is globally critical. And we do want to make sure we've got confidence in our supply chains. We want to see expansion on some of these businesses. But if you've got the Fed trying to dull business and you've got Congress trying to promote business, you're ending up in this environment where inflation started to moderate from the peak, but it's getting stuck in this range now because right. There's still mm-hmm. enough demand. There's still enough pressure coming from one side. And the Fed is kind of looking at it and saying, there's only so much we can do. So, you know, I think the dislocation of the workers, wage pressures on the service side are still 5.5% to 6%. The fact that mortgage rates fell down to sub 3% and people refinanced, yeah. right? And people here domestically in the United States, they locked in 15 to 30 year mortgages under 3%.
Right.
Nobody wants to sell a home today. Right. And so trying to find a house, you're still paying up on rentals. I think it's these combinations of unique factors, dislocated factors, where the Fed has to look at it and say, how much can we do on that? We feel like we've done our job in terms of raising rates. If we get easing on some of these other fronts, I do think inflation comes down. But they're looking, they've lost some of the confidence.
Yep.
And so it's become a wait and see game.
Yeah.
It's kind of a unique aspect, and we were talking about this earlier, a unique aspect about the U.S. situation in terms mm-hmm. of U.S. consumers and U.S. families. Millions of people in this country have locked in mortgage rates
yeah.
of 3% for the next couple of decades, right? And that's somewhat unique in the sense that most countries around the world don't really have this, you know, large retail market for 30-year mortgages where right. anyone can just go and lock their rate for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Typically, a lot of places around the world actually are dealing with things like, you know, mortgages that reset every quarter that are more floating rate-like, or right. if they're fixed, it's for a very short period of time. So in a way, we are lucky here in the U.S. to have been somewhat sheltered from the rate hikes, at least yeah. temporarily, because
yep.
we're still enjoying the benefits of the, you know, the very low mortgage rates that were available for many years.
Right? But in a weird way, creating a different problem when it comes to inventory, because now you
Absolutely.
Have people that are saying, I'm not moving for the next 20 years because I can't replicate this mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas
Absolutely.
Somebody in Norway, for example, might say, well, it doesn't matter if I move because my rate's going to adjust anyways. So
True.
It's mm-hmm. it's an interesting kind of push-pull that's happening right
yeah,
now.
Exactly. Yeah, just like sure. you were saying, Andrew, it's that combination of factors that's really makes everything so hard to predict. And
right.
throw away the textbook.
Yes.
It's not in there.
Yep. Yep.
I hate to pin you on something, but if we look at where our projections are for rate hike, rate cut, I mean, kind of where we look at the next 12 months, maybe we'll do a percentage chance. Higher percentage chance, in your opinion, that we see a rate hike or a rate cut as the next move. Let's start there.
Yeah.
And then more than that, past that maybe, you know, the trend, do we see it? Do we see the Fed just holding tight, saying, we're fine where we're at, we're going to let this movie play out? Mm-hmm. Or do we think that there is more apparatus, if you will, that they need to pull and maneuver and adjust to try to get something to happen the way they want?
Yeah, I mean, I think their bias right now is towards a cut. If you listen to Powell's, as an economist, like, that's my Super Bowl. When the Fed comes out, I pop popcorn, I grab a Diet Coke. I'm excited for when the dot plots, their economic projections came out.
Okay, it was exciting until that
point. Yeah. then the Fed, so I write our Fed, I watch every single press conference right after each of those meetings. And at the latest one, right, this is the meeting where Powell came out, and people are like, are they going to talk about a cut? Is that still on the radar? At this last meeting, he said, you know, our confidence has changed a little bit, because over the first 3 months of the year, rather than continuing a relatively steady path down towards 2%, inflation has kind of moderated and actually ticked up a little bit through the first quarter of the year. Somebody asked him specifically during that conference, do you think that there is a chance of a hike? And he's like, we're not considering that right now. Okay. They want the confidence that they've done enough. They want the confidence that the models that told them, if you get this far, things will come under control. I think they really believe that if they're patient, that it's tight enough. And the other thing that they're looking at is, if we see any moderation in inflation, they think about where rates are at, right? About 5.5% Fed funds here in the United States. If inflation moderates at all, the real rate, the inflation adjusted rate is widening out. And so I think they look at that and say, we don't need to hike. Even if we don't do anything, if inflation moderates, financial conditions in their minds are tightening. Now, if the data turns, if we see an acceleration on some front, that could change their picture. They have been really trying to be data dependent, but they're seeing international moves as well, right? And the international moves, well, the U.S. will look at it and the Fed will look at it and say, we are our own body. It matters, right? What other countries do, it impacts exchange rates, it impacts cross-currency transactions. And so, you know, I don't know if you want to speak to what's going on more internationally, but it may push the Fed towards following a similar path.
And I think that's really interesting, because I think we are about to enter a really interesting phase in global central banking, because virtually every major central bank around the world is indicating one way or another that they are going to they intend to start cutting rate. And I think Switzerland that actually cut rates 25 bips a couple of weeks back. So I think to me that's really interesting, because you're right. I mean, there would almost be a scenario where the Fed wouldn't want to be the only central bank raising rates or not cutting rates. I mean, the strong dollar is already a challenge for a lot of U.S. businesses. Imagine what would happen if that rate differential was even more pronounced.
Right.
So I think there will be some, I don't know if pressure is the right word, but I think that momentum is going to start building, and we're going to see we're going to see rate cuts, I think, you know, likelihood.
What scares the Fed more than anything right now?
What scares them the most, I think, is cutting too aggressively. I think everybody who's on the Fed, and I think Powell's kind of at the front of this, this is going to be their legacy at the end of the day. I mean, what they did during COVID certainly matters, but now the question that's been out there for the last 2, 3, 4 years is, can they stick the landing? Yeah. And everybody's looking at the inflation that came, and the question is, you know, are you Arthur Burns, who in the 1970s, right, when inflation started to come down, declared victory too early and it reaccelerated, or are you Paul Volcker? And you stick to it until the job is done, right? And it's interesting, because you go back in time, if you can go look at the reporting at that time period, they liked Burns. People liked Burns. He was cutting, he was easing, it was good for business. Politically, they liked him. And they didn't like Volcker, because he did the hard thing at the time. But then we look back later, and the unpopular person in the moment all of a sudden is the hero, because at the end of the day, we look back and say, well, it was painful, it was correct. And I think there is this, they want to start this process, they want to start the movements, but I think sitting there lingering at the back of their minds, right, is, we can't let inflation reaccelerate, we can't let this thing move higher, we can't. If they cut and had to hike afterwards, I think they would look at it and say, we made a big mistake. Mm-hmm. So patience, patience, patience. And if we have to wait longer to feel confident, that we're going to be able to maintain that path lower, I think they are willing to wait to do that.
So, thoughts on that?
No, I agree. And it's funny, the Volcker comments, because there's been a lot of comparison, especially when they were in that tightening phase. And I always felt that, you know, it was a bit of a stretch to compare Powell to Volcker.
Right.
I mean, Volcker had, I think we had something like 6% real interest rates for like a couple of years.
Right.
So it's a little bit different than what we're seeing now. But fundamentally, I agree that they are very aware of the risk of cutting too soon, too early. Mm-hmm. And it's just crazy to think back to where we were earlier this year, when you looked at markets where people were actually expecting 5 or 6 rate cuts or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
And now we're like, well, we're lucky if we're getting 1 rate cut type of thing. Right?
Yeah.
So yeah, and I think as you get closer to the election, obviously that looms because they don't want it to look political. And
exactly.
So you start to get backed into a corner a little bit where closer we get to November, you've got that push-pull in the Fed's mind of, well, we can do this if we have to, but now it's going to look political, and they just don't want to be that
show
body.
That they are independent.
They also don't like to surprise people. So they want to, in the next meeting or two, their hope is they see enough data that they can kind of pre-signal.
Yeah,
here's our expected path, and we'll change if the data doesn't justify it. But they want to set that out in advance so it doesn't look like they're responding to anything as we get to the election. Now, when we get past that, I think the markets, when they're pricing in, saying 1 to 2 cuts this year still, December's kind of the one they're looking at. They're looking at it and saying, okay, if we get to that point in time,
post-election,
election's behind us, that's no longer the consideration.
Yep.
And at least at that point in time, if we truly do have tight enough monetary conditions, if we are continuing to see some weakness in the economic data, retail sales have slowed.
Yep.
Some of those pieces have slowed, right? That should give us plenty of time between now and then to confirm if the trend is back in place. And if we're ready to start that cut cycle, they should be able to, at that point, have the freedom to not have to worry about these extra variables.
So in your opinion, as a result of that, not perfectly correlated, but as a result of that, mortgage rates probably stay about where they're at, kind of float within the range bound, the range band, if you will, that they've been in for the last, call it, 6 months?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think they could start to trend a little bit. I think this is what's happening kind of broadly with the fixed income market. You see spreads right now are tight across most of the board. And I think what people are looking at is this expectation of Fed cuts. Once the process starts, people are looking and saying, it's not just one cut. It's going to be 1, 2, 3. You know, the Fed has said they ultimately want to get Fed funds down to about 2.5%. Now, whether they'll be able to do so, that's what we're going to have to see. But historically, right, there's been this kind of relationship between, let's say, 10-year treasuries and mortgage rates. If you expect the 10-year is going to moderate a little bit once the cut process starts, I do think that the mortgage rates will move with it. Now, let's say historically, again, we just kind of look at the data. The 10-year treasury's typically been about 150 basis points above Fed funds. Well, that would put us, okay, that puts us at about 2. If the Fed gets to where they want to, it puts the 10-year at about 4.5%, which would put the 30-year mortgage at about 5.5%, right? So we're not totally out of that range. I do think we could see a little bit of moderation. And I think people typically go too far in both directions, either when the cut process starts saying, oh, they're not going to stop at 2.5%, they're going to keep moving lower. But I don't think we're going back to the 3%.
Yeah.
That sub 3%. Right. I just think that in this type of environment, but people will adapt to it. I mean, go back to 78 to 81 and mortgage markets and business financing markets.
Right.
We're trying to make these decisions. And they didn't look at it and say, wow, rates rose up. I'm not going to do anything until they're back down to where they were before.
Right.
When things started to normalize a little bit, they kind of just got comfortable again and said, we're going to start reengaging. And I think we'll see that again this time.
Yeah. Let's switch gears a little bit and get into just kind of your garden variety multinational corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we think they sit right now? We're not talking about the tech company. We're not talking about, you know, Apple and Google and just the, you get so much press. It's time to, you know, kind of say, hey, what about the other, you know, whatever, 492 companies in the S&P 500? I mean, if you picked one out of a hat, what are we likely to see with that corporation as far as the health of that corporation?
So if you were to break down the Magnificent Seven and the other 493, like last year was a weird year where the Magnificent Seven saw earnings rise about 20% and the other 493 saw their earnings fall about 6%. This year, that dynamic is starting to shift. They are starting to pick up a little bit. The earnings expectations this year for the 493 is about 6-7%. Next year in 2025, it's expected to be closer to 12%. They're seeing some recovery, but at the same time, they're adapting and responding to some of the dynamics that are around them. You think about, right, these changes in rates. A lot of people issued debt in 2020. That unpredictable time period. We saw this across the world where people said, I don't know what's happening with COVID. I don't know how long it's going to be here. I don't know whether this is over in 2020 or 2021 or 2022. So what did they do? They issued some debt. They refinanced their balance sheets in order to put them in a position so that they could withstand that uncertainty. Yeah. As they're coming out on the other side of that, what we're starting to see is people doing the refinancing, but rates are notably higher than where they were. Mm-hmm. It's 200, 300 basis points higher. And so companies, one of the big questions I think that's out there is for these companies, they haven't really let go of workers. The unemployment rate remains near one of the lowest levels that we've seen in 60 years. If you look at their hiring rates relative to other activity, I think some of them got a little bit out over their skis. I think we're going to see some slowdown in hiring. I think we're going to see some slowdown in things like CapEx, spending on these businesses, but I do think they're going to weather most of this storm. And I think you're going to see that broadening out, which we've seen typically after slowdowns economically or after periods of concentration. I think you will see some broadening out. Now they're going to look to the rest of the world. How is the rest? Because you think about an S&P 500 company, what? Roughly half of their income comes from outside of the United States, right?
Right.
And so that becomes the next question of how do we compare? And if rates are being cut internationally, that's obviously going to impact things like exchange rates. But the international recovery could be almost as important for these companies as what's happening here domestically.
Mm. Interesting.
I've been asking a fair number of questions. Syl, do you have any additional questions before we wrap up here?
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned what's happening internationally.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your thoughts on Europe, because Europe is still kind of an area of the world that is plagued with really low growth.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of talk about Europe being just not competitive anymore for a number of different reasons, and having completely missed out on a lot of the main kind of current economic drivers, if you will.
Right.
So does that tell the full story, or is there kind of a turnaround opportunity potentially here?
I mean, I think there is opportunity. The one way I heard it, and I think I saw it in the Wall Street Journal, they said, you know, the thing that's been going on over the last 10, 15, 20 years is that the U.S. has been innovating, China's been replicating, and Europe's been regulating, right? And from a regulatory perspective, I get why they're doing it. There's privacy concerns. There's things like that. But you think about what has been the major growth driver for the United States, particularly from the market standpoint, right? It's technology. That has been the dominant area. And you look at Europe's sector composition, or you look at essentially any other country outside of the United States, maybe, you know, you can kind of sort of include China in that. But that regulatory environment has kind of diminished the entrepreneurial spirit in some of these leading edge technologies. And that becomes critically important. Now, we're seeing other countries step in there. We're seeing India step in. We're seeing Vietnam step in. South Korea's engaged. Obviously, you've got places like Taiwan. There is opportunity.
Right.
There is opportunity, because you think about it, they've got unbelievable educational environments. You've got strong quality of life. You've got incredibly capable people. The example that we've given in the past, you can have a racehorse of an economy, right? The best entrepreneurs, the best innovators, and that is a vehicle that can provide fast growth, but what's the size of the jockey, right? The size of the jockey, whether that's regulatory or tax burdens or whatever those things are, it can weigh down the economic performance. And you can get enough weight on that jockey that the horse is still moving forward, but it goes from being a racehorse into a plow horse that's kind of stumbling along. Now the jockey loses some weight. And you could be, and we've seen this. We've seen countries make some of those transitions before. Some South American countries, I think, are trying to do that. Right. It's not an easy process. But I think that's kind of the environment. If you want to speed up growth, innovation is so critical.
Yeah.
And some of that innovation requires like an opportunity to fail. And it's going to take some risk taking in that. The regulatory question there is, how much risk are you willing to put out there? How much are you willing to accept in your financial markets? How much are you willing to let companies do in order to attempt things, in order to try new technologies? If you stifle that, you're probably going to stifle the progress along the way. Mm-hmm. That's how I see it.
Just going back to your question about just the health of the average American company, I think one challenge that some companies may have faced is just finding you know, people to hire.
Right.
And just that the job market has just been so incredibly tight in the U.S. for so long, and unemployment rates have been so long, so low for so long. How much longer can that last? Because, I mean, historically, I mean, we've never been able to really sustain very, very low unemployment for for a long time. And usually, you know, it leads to some sort of slowdown. You know, is this time different? Is there enough momentum in this economy, enough breadth to sustain this really low unemployment for many more years?
Yeah, it's a great question. Now, one of the factors that's helping keep the unemployment rate low is that we have demographic shifts that are taking place, right? You think about who's the largest demographic group in the United States. It's the baby boomers, right? We saw this, again, in a lot of international markets. What's the average age of that generation here in 2024?
Right.
They're 66 years old. What we've seen over the last 4 years, Fed estimates about 2.7 million excess retirements versus what we saw pre-COVID. So, you know, we still have people coming into the labor market, but there's been a higher exit rate. It means less available new stock coming in. Some of that's been offset by some things like immigration. But it is still, we're still hearing from companies, particularly small and mid-sized, it's very hard to find qualified workers.
Right.
And the other factor that's out there is the environment that we went through in 2020 into 2021. We had the health and the safety concerns. When companies were hiring people and they were training them and we were doing the remote work, companies are finding that some of those people 2, 3, 4 years on are not as developed as maybe prior groups that had come through, because there's just something that was missed about the we're not surrounded by people who can teach us or look over our shoulder. We don't have that collaboration. And so there's kind of these factors where they need to hire a little bit more because they lost skilled workers. They need to hire a little bit more because people haven't developed as fast. But at the same time, the skilled workers are leaving at a faster pace. I think that will eventually even out. I don't expect we're going to stay below 4% on the unemployment rate, because we've also hired beyond what is normally seen, particularly on the manufacturing sector, but demand is still here.
Yeah.
So until that demand diminishes, and if the Fed does their job, it will diminish, and that unemployment rate will tick up. I think it's temporary, but there's things that are helping keep it contained in the short to intermediate term.
The last question that I have, is, and then we can wrap up here unless you have any additional, how concerned is the Fed, how concerned should the markets be and the consumers be with 2025, 2026, 2027, talking about corporations, they don't need the square footage anymore.
Right.
They don't need the space anymore that they have. These leases are starting to reset, right? We have, everything is coming, and it seems, if I'm not mistaken, it looked like Europe was, the date for them was 2025-ish, U.S. maybe closer to 2026, but tremendous number of notes on buildings and leases on spaces, and is this much ado about nothing, or is this actually something?
Yeah, it's tricky because, you know, just to look at, again, some of the numbers, when we think about how many people are coming into the office today, how much commercial real estate space do you need? I look at companies, there's a company called Castle that does the credit, the swipes, the card that you use to get into buildings. Recent readings, we're about 50% levels of where we were in 2019, right? The number of spaces that people you have coming into the office. So you have seen downsizing. Now, in that space, the commercial real estate also, they structure their loans a lot of times differently than something like a mortgage where you're kind of paying some principal and interest. This is typically you're paying the interest and then you pay the principal when it comes due at the end. As that's coming due, they're realizing a lot of these properties aren't worth as much as they, and the demand isn't there because people are finding other ways. Now, do I think we'll see some return? I do think you will. If you look at major markets, you look at somewhere like New York, you look at Chicago, you look at, you know, the big business markets, we are starting to see a pickup again in terms of back to office. With financials was one of the first ones that came back in larger numbers. Technology recently has started to come back in some slightly higher numbers. When you had this remote work, I think people have said, if you had a strong culture, if you had a strong company, if you had a strong base, you could do this remote thing and people could still be productive. But it's harder to build a new company and it's harder to onboard people. So I think what we'll ultimately see is somewhere in between. In the short term, the bigger question is who's holding the debt?
Yeah.
Right. And it tends to not be big banks. They don't typically play
right.
in the local rental markets. It's right. not the big four. It's smaller and more regional type of banks. Now, that may cause some disruptions as we move later in this year into next year. But I will say that the big banks, kind of in many of the markets, have some capacity to kind of bring some of those companies in. We saw that with Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic last year. That was a completely different issue. I don't think those banks really want it. JP Morgan, Bank of America, they don't want to play in the local real estate market space, but if push comes to shove, they can help provide some of that liquidity. But I don't think that story's over. I think you will see a little bit of downsizing. Private markets are coming in. They're trying to do some luxury real estate from the commercial real estate. The biggest trend that I'm seeing, though, when I talk to the Society of Civil Engineers, is they said there's more that's starting to take place in the suburbs.
Interesting.
As the activity is out there and you still want people to get together, maybe you don't need the 80-story building in downtown, but you've got space for your team to meet 20 minutes outside of downtown where the people are leaving. That could be a situation that we see movement towards, which keeps activity moving, but it reshuffles where people are living, maybe where they're working, and we got to figure out how to deal with those mortgages.
We could go on for hours and hours, but we can't. At some point, we have to stop. Still any final questions or are you?
No, thoughts? I think like you said, we could just talk to you for hours, but I think in the interest of time, I'm sure there's a great hotel nearby that you have to go in and leave a review for us later tonight. So
very good. Well, thank you so much for your time, Andrew. We appreciate it. Thanks again for listening to another episode and watching another episode of Give Me Some Truth. We'll be back soon.
Walker Condon Financial Advisors is a registered investment advisor with the SEC. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training. The opinions expressed by the participants of this podcast are their own and do not reflect the opinions of Walker Condon Financial Advisors. All statements and opinions expressed are based upon information considered reliable, although it should not be relied upon as such. Any statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Information expressed does not take into account your specific situation or objectives and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for any individual. Viewers are encouraged to seek advice from a qualified tax, legal, or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Past performance is not indicative of future performance.
You gotta leave your money behind you. Raise your hand to the sky. Ask the masses for silence.